politician with good teeth, and the psychopaths who run their countries into the ground and take large parts of the world with them. Among the pacifying features of democracies is that their leadership selection procedure penalizes an utter lack of empathy, and their checks and balances limit the damage that a grandiose leader can do. Even within autocracies, the personality of a leader, a Gorbachev as opposed to a Stalin, can have an enormous impact on the statistics of violence. The damage done by the drive for dominance can be multiplied in a second way. This multiplier depends on a feature of the social mind that can be introduced with a benign anecdote. Every December, my heart is warmed by a local tradition. The province of Nova Scotia sends a towering spruce to the city of Boston for its Christmas tree in gratitude for the humanitarian aid that Boston organizations extended to Haligonians after the horrendous 1917 explosion of a munitions-laden ship in Halifax Harbor. As a Canadian expatriate in New England, I get to feel good twice. Once in gratitude for the generous help that had been extended to my fellow Canucks, once in appreciation for the thoughtful gift that is being returned to my Boston brethren. Yet this entire ritual is, when you think about it, rather odd. I was not a party to either act of generosity, and so I neither earned nor should express gratitude. The people who find, fell, and send the tree never met the original victims and helpers, nor did the people who erect and decorate it. For all I know, not a single person touched by the tragedy is alive today. Yet we all feel the emotions that would be appropriate to a transaction of sympathy and gratitude between a pair of individual people. Everyone's mind contains a representation called Nova Scotia and a representation called Boston, which are granted the full suite of moral emotions and valuations, and individual men and women act out their roles in the social behavior that follows from them. A part of an individual's personal identity is melded with the identity of the groups that he or she affiliates with. Each group occupies a slot in their minds that is very much like the slot occupied by an individual person, complete with beliefs, desires, and praiseworthy or blameworthy traits. This social identity appears to be an adaptation to the reality of groups and the welfare of individuals. Our fitness depends not just on our own fortunes, but on the fortunes of the bands, villages, and tribes we find ourselves in, which are bound together by real or fictive kinship, networks of reciprocity, and a commitment to public goods, including group defense. Within the group, some people help to police the provision of public goods by punishing any parasite who doesn't contribute a fair share, and they are rewarded by the group's esteem. These and other contributions to the group's welfare are psychologically implemented by a partial loss of boundaries between the group and the self. On behalf of our group, we can feel sympathetic, grateful, angry, guilty, trustful, or mistrustful with regard to some other group, and we spread these emotions over the members of that group, regardless of what they have done as individuals to deserve them. Loyalty to groups in competition, such as sports teams or political parties, encourages us to play out our instinct for dominance vicariously. Jerry Seinfeld once remarked that today's athletes churn through the rosters of sports teams so rapidly that a fan can no longer support a group of players. He is reduced to rooting for their team logo and uniforms. You are standing and cheering and yelling for your clothes to beat the clothes from another city. But stand and cheer we do. The mood of a sports fan rises and falls with the fortunes of his team. The loss of boundaries can literally be assayed in the biochemistry lab. Men's testosterone level rises when their team defeats a rival in a game, just as it rises when they personally defeat a rival in a wrestling match or in singles tennis. It also rises or falls when a favored political candidate wins or loses an election. The dark side of our communal feelings is a desire for our own group to dominate another group, no matter how we feel about its members as individuals. In a set of famous experiments, the psychologist Henri Teufel told participants that they belonged to one of two groups, defined by some trivial difference, such as whether they preferred the paintings of Paul Klee or Vasily Kandinsky. He then gave them an opportunity to distribute money between a member of their group and a member of the other group. The members were identified only by number, and the participants themselves had nothing to gain or lose from their choice. Not only did they allocate more money to their instant group mates, but they preferred to penalize a member of the other group. For example, 7 cents for a fellow Clay fan, 1 cent for a Kandinsky fan, then to benefit both individuals at the expense of the experimenter, 19 cents for a fellow Clay fan, 25 cents for a Kandinsky fan. A preference for one's group emerges early in life and seems to be something that must be unlearned, not learned. Developmental psychologists have shown that preschoolers profess racist attitudes that would appall their liberal parents, and that even babies prefer to interact with people of the same race and accent. The psychologists Jim Sedanius and Felicio Prato have proposed that people, to varying degrees, harbor a motive they call social dominance, though a more intuitive term is tribalism, the desire that social groups be organized into a hierarchy, generally with one's own group dominant over the others. A social dominance orientation, they show, inclines people to a sweeping array of opinions and values, including patriotism, racism, fate, karma, caste, national destiny, militarism, toughness on crime, and defensiveness of existing arrangements of authority and inequality. An orientation away from social dominance, in contrast, inclines people to humanism, socialism, feminism, universal rights, political progressivism, and the egalitarian and pacifist themes in the Christian Bible. The theory of social dominance implies that race, the focus of so much discussion on prejudice, is psychologically unimportant. As Teufel's experiments showed, people can divide the world into in-groups and out-groups based on any ascribed similarity, including tastes in expressionist painters. The psychologists Robert Kurzban, John Tooby, and Leda Cosmides point out that in human evolutionary history, members of different races were separated by oceans, deserts, and mountain ranges, which is why racial differences evolved in the first place and seldom met each other face to face. One's adversaries were villages, clans, and tribes of the same race. What looms large in people's minds is not race, but coalition. It just so happens that nowadays many coalitions, neighborhoods, gangs, countries, coincide with races. Any invidious treatment that people display toward other races can be just as readily elicited by members of other coalitions. Experiments by the psychologists G. Richard Tucker, Wallace Lambert, and later Catherine Kinsler have shown that one of the most vivid delineators of prejudice is speech. People distrust people who speak with an unfamiliar accent. The effect goes back to the charming story of the origin of the word shibboleth in Judges chapter 12, verses 5 through 6. And the Gileadites took the passages of Jordan before the Ephraimites, and it was so, that when those Ephraimites which were escaped said, "Let me go over," that the men of Gilead said unto him, "Art thou an Ephraimite?" If he said, "Nay," then they said unto him, "Say now Shibboleth," and he said, "Sibboleth," for he could not frame to pronounce it right. Then they took him and slew him at the passages of the Jordan, and there fell at that time of the Ephraimites 42,000. The phenomenon of nationalism can be understood as an interaction between psychology and history. It is the welding together of three things: the emotional impulse behind tribalism, a cognitive conception of the group as a people sharing a language, territory, and ancestry, and the political apparatus of government. Nationalism, Einstein said, is the measles of the human race. That isn't always true. Sometimes it's just a head cold. But nationalism can get virulent when it is comorbid with the group equivalent of narcissism in the psychiatric sense, namely a big but fragile ego with an unearned claim to preeminence. Recall that narcissism can trigger violence when the narcissist is enraged by an insolent signal from reality. Combine narcissism with nationalism, and you get a deadly phenomenon that political scientists call ressentiment, French for resentment. the conviction that one's nation or civilization has a historical right to greatness despite its lowly status, which can only be explained by the malevolence of an internal or external foe. Resentment whips up the emotions of thwarted dominance, humiliation, envy, and rage, to which narcissists are prone. Historians such as Lya Greenfield and Daniel Shiroe have attributed the major wars and genocides in the early decades of the 20th century to resentment in Germany and Russia. Both nations felt they were realizing their rightful claims to preeminence, which perfidious enemies had denied them. It has not escaped the notice of observers of the contemporary scene that Russia and the Islamic world both nurse resentments about their undeserved lack of greatness, and that these emotions are non-negligible threats to peace. Heading in the other direction are European countries like Holland, Sweden, and Denmark that stopped playing the preeminence game in the 18th century and pegged their self-esteem to more tangible, if less heart-pounding, achievements like making money and giving their citizens a pleasant lifestyle. Together with countries that never cared about being magnificent in the first place, like Canada, Singapore, and New Zealand, their national pride, though considerable, is commensurate with their achievements, and in the arena of interstate relations, they don't make trouble. Group-level ambition also determines the fate of ethnic neighbors. Experts on ethnicity dismiss the conventional wisdom that ancient hatreds inevitably keep neighboring peoples at each other's throats. After all, there are some 6,000 languages spoken on the planet, at least 600 of which have substantial numbers of speakers. By any reckoning, the number of deadly ethnic conflicts that actually break out is a tiny fraction of the number that could break out. In 1996, James Fearon and David Layton carried out one such reckoning. They focused on two parts of the world that each housed a combustible mixture of ethnic groups: the republics of the newly dissolved Soviet Union in the early 1990s, which had 45 of them, and newly decolonized Africa from 1960 to 1979, which had at least 160, probably many more. Fearon and Layton counted the number of civil wars and incidents of intercommunal violence, such as deadly riots, as a proportion of the number of pairs of neighboring ethnic groups. They found that in the former Soviet Union, violence broke out in about 4.4% of the opportunities, and in Africa it broke out in fewer than 1%. Developed countries with mixtures of ethnic groups, such as New Zealand, Malaysia, Canada, Belgium, and recently the United States, have even better track records of ethnic nonviolence. The groups may get on each other's nerves, but they don't kill each other. Nor should this be surprising. Even if ethnic groups are like people and constantly jockey for status, remember that most of the time, people don't come to blows either. Several things determine whether ethnic groups can coexist without bloodshed. As Fearon and Layton point out, one important emollient is the way a group treats a loose cannon who attacks a member of the other group. If the malefactor is reeled in and punished by his own community, the victimized group can classify the incident as a one-on-one crime, rather than as the first strike in a group-against-group war. Recall that one reason international peacekeepers are effective is that they can chasten spoilers on one side to the satisfaction of the other. The political scientist Stephen von Evera suggests that an even bigger factor is ideology. Things get ugly when intermingled ethnic groups long for states of their own, hope to unite with their diasporas in other countries, keep long memories of harms committed by their neighbors' ancestors, while being unrepentant for harms committed by their own, and live under crappy governments that mythologize one group's glorious history while excluding others from the social contract. Many peaceable countries today are in the process of redefining the nation-state by purging it of tribalist psychology. The government no longer defines itself as a crystallization of the yearning of the soul of a particular ethnic group, but as a compact that embraces all the people and groups that happen to find themselves on a contiguous plot of land. The machinery of government is often Rube Goldbergian, with complex arrangements of devolution and special status and power sharing and affirmative action, and the contraption is held together by a few national symbols, such as a rugby team. People root for clothing instead of blood and soil. It is a messiness appropriate to the messiness of people's divided selves, with coexisting identities as individuals and as members of overlapping groups. Social dominance is a guy thing. It's not surprising that men, the more dominance-obsessed gender, have stronger tribalist feelings than women, including racism, militarism, and comfort with inequality. But men are more likely to find themselves at the receiving end of racism, too. Contrary to the common assumption that racism and sexism are twin prejudices propping up a white male power structure, with African-American women in double jeopardy, Sedanius and Prato found that minority women are far less likely to be the target of racist treatment than minority men. Men's attitudes toward women may be paternalistic or exploitative, but they are not combative, as they tend to be with other men. Sedanius and Prato explained the difference with reference to the evolution of these invidious attitudes. Sexism ultimately arises from the genetic incentive of men to control the behavior, especially the sexual behavior, of women. Tribalism arises from the incentive of groups of men to compete with other groups for access to resources and mates. The gender gaps in overconfidence, personal violence, and group-against-group hostility raise a frequently asked question. Would the world be more peaceful if women were in charge? The question is just as interesting if the tense and mood are changed. Has the world become more peaceful because women are more in charge? And will the world become more peaceful when women are even more in charge? The answer to all three, I think, is a qualified yes. Qualified because the link between sex and violence is more complicated than just men are from Mars. In War and Gender, the political scientist Joshua Goldstein reviewed the intersection of these two categories and discovered that throughout history and in every society, men have overwhelmingly made up and commanded the armies. The archetype of the Amazons and other women warriors owe more to men being turned on by the image of strapping young women in battle gear, like Lara Croft and Xena, than to historical reality. Even in the feminist 21st century, 97% of the world's soldiers and 99.9% of the world's combat soldiers are male. In Israel, which famously drafts both sexes, women warriors spend most of their time in clinics or behind desks. Men can also boast about occupying all the top slots in history's list of conquering maniacs, bloodthirsty tyrants, and genocidal thugs. But women have not been conscientious objectors through all of this bloodshed. On various occasions, they have led armed forces or served in combat, and they frequently egg their men into battle or provide logistical support, whether as camp followers in earlier centuries or industrial riveters in the 20th. Many queens and empresses, including Isabella of Spain, Mary and Elizabeth I of England, and Catherine the Great of Russia, acquitted themselves well in internal oppression and external conquest, and several 20th century heads of state, such as Margaret Thatcher, Golda Meir, Indira Gandhi, and Chandrika Kumaratunga, led their nations in war. The discrepancy between what women are capable of doing in war and what they typically do is no paradox. In traditional societies, women had to worry about abduction, rape, and infanticide by the enemy, so it's not surprising that they should want their men to be on the winning side of a war. In societies with standing armies, differences between the sexes, including upper body strength, the willingness to plunder and kill, and the ability to bear and raise children, combined with the nuisance of mixed-sex armies, such as romantic intrigue between the sexes and dominance contests within them, have always militated toward a division of labor by sex, with the men providing the cannon fodder. As for leadership, women in any era who find themselves in positions of power will obviously carry out their job responsibilities, which in many eras have included the waging of war. A queen in an age of competing dynasties and empires could hardly have afforded to be the world's only pacifist, even if she were so inclined. And of course, the two sexes' traits overlap considerably, even in those for which the averages might differ. So with any trait relevant to military leadership or combat, many women will be more capable than most men. But over the long sweep of history, women have been and will be a pacifying force. Traditional war is a man's game. Tribal women never band together and raid neighboring villages to abduct grooms. This sex difference set the stage for Aristophanes' Lysistrata, in which the women of Greece go on a sex strike to pressure their men to end the Peloponnesian War. In the 19th century, feminism often overlapped with pacifism and other anti-violence movements, such as abolitionism and animal rights. In the 20th, women's groups have been active and intermittently effective in protesting nuclear tests, the Vietnam War, and violent strife in Argentina, Northern Ireland, and the former Soviet Union and Yugoslavia. In a review of almost 300 American public opinion polls between the 1930s and 1980s, men were found to support the more violent or forceful option in 87% of the questions, the others being tied. For example, they were more supportive of military confrontation with Germany in 1939, Japan in 1940, Russia in 1960, and Vietnam in 1968. In every American presidential election since 1980, women have cast more votes for the Democratic candidate than men have, and in 2000 and 2004, majorities of women reversed the preference of men and voted against George W. Bush. Though women are slightly more peace-loving than their men folk, the men and women of a given society have correlated opinions. In 1961, Americans were asked whether the country should fight an all-out nuclear war rather than live under communist rule. 87% of the men said yes, while only 75% of the women felt that way. Proof that women are pacifist only in comparison to men of the same time in society. Gender gaps are larger when an issue divides the country, as in the Vietnam War, smaller when there is greater agreement, as in World War II, and non-existent when the issue obsesses the entire society, as in the attitudes among Israelis and Arabs toward a resolution of the Arab-Israeli conflict. But women's position in society can affect its fondness for war, even if the women themselves are not opposing war. A recognition of women's rights and an opposition to war go together. In Middle Eastern countries, the poll respondents who were more favorable to gender equality were also more favorable to nonviolent solutions to the Arab-Israeli conflict. Several ethnographic surveys of traditional cultures have found that the better a society treats its women, the less it embraces war. The same is true for modern countries with the usual continuum running from Western Europe to blue American states and to red American states to Islamic countries such as Afghanistan and Pakistan. As we shall see in Chapter 10, societies that empower their women are less likely to end up with large cohorts of rootless young men, with their penchant for making trouble. And, of course, the decades of the long peace and the new peace have been the decades of the revolution in women's rights. We don't know what causes what, but biology and history suggest that all else being equal, a world in which women have more influence will be a world with fewer wars. Dominance is an adaptation to anarchy, and it serves no purpose in a society that has undergone a civilizing process or in an international system regulated by agreements and norms. Anything that deflates the concept of dominance is likely to drive down the frequency of fights between individuals and wars between groups. That doesn't mean that the emotions behind dominance will go away. They are very much a part of our biology, especially in a certain gender, but they can be marginalized. The mid and late 20th century saw a deconstruction of the concept of dominance and related virtues like manliness, honor, prestige, and glory. Part of the deflation came from the informalization process, as in the Marx Brothers' burlesque of jingoism in Duck Soup. Partly it has come from women's inroads into professional life. Women have the psychological distance to see contests of dominance as boys making noise. So as they have become more influential, dominance has lost some of its aura. Anyone who has worked in a mixed-sex environment is familiar with a woman belittling the wasteful posturing of her male colleagues as typical male behavior. Partly it has come from cosmopolitanism, which exposes us to exaggerated cultures of honor in other countries and thereby gives us a perspective on our own. The word macho, recently borrowed from Spanish, has a disdainful air, connoting self-indulgent swagger rather than manly heroism. The village people's campy macho man and other homoerotic iconography has further undermined the trappings of masculine dominance. Another deflationary force, I think, is the progress of biological science and its influence on literate culture. People have increasingly understood the drive for dominance as a vestige of the evolutionary process. A quantitative analysis of Google books shows recent leaps in the popularity of the biological jargon behind dominance, including testosterone, beginning in the 1940s, pecking order, and dominance hierarchy, beginning in the 1960s, and alpha male in the 1990s. Joining them in the 1980s was the facetious pseudo-medical term testosterone poisoning. Each of these phrases belittles the stakes in contests for dominance. They imply that the glory men seek may be a figment of their primate imaginations, the symptom of a chemical in their bloodstream, the acting out of instincts that make us laugh when we see them in roosters and baboons. Compare the distancing power of these biological terms to older words like glorious and honorable, which objectify the prize in a contest of dominance, presupposing that certain accomplishments just are glorious or honorable in the very nature of things. The frequency of both terms has been steadily falling in English language books for a century and a half. An ability to hold our instincts up to the light, rather than naively accepting their products in our consciousness as just the way things are, is the first step in discounting them when they lead to harmful ends. Revenge. The determination to hurt someone who has hurt you has long been exalted in purple prose. The Hebrew Bible is obsessed with revenge, giving us pithy expressions like, "Whoso sheddeth blood will have his blood shed," "an eye for an eye," and "vengeance is mine." Homer's Achilles describes it as sweeter than flowing honey, welling up like smoke from the breasts of men. Shylock cites it as the climax in his listing of human universals, and when asked what he will do with his pound of flesh, replies, "To bait fish withal. If it will feed nothing else, it will feed my revenge." People in other cultures also wax poetic about the settling of scores. Milo Vangelis, born into a feuding clan of Montenegrins and later a vice president of communist Yugoslavia, called vengeance the glow in our eyes, the flame in our cheeks, the pounding in our temples, the word that turned to stone in our throats on our hearing that our blood had been shed. A New Guinean man, upon hearing that the killer of his uncle had been paralyzed by an arrow, said, "I feel as if I am developing wings. I feel as if I am about to fly off, and I am very happy." The Apache chief Geronimo, savoring his massacre of four Mexican army companies, wrote, "Still covered with the blood of my enemies, still holding my conquering weapon, still hot with the joy of battle, victory, and vengeance, I was surrounded by the Apache braves and made war chief of all the Apaches. Then I gave the orders for scalping the slain. I could not call back my loved ones. I could not bring back the dead Apaches, but I could rejoice in this revenge." Daly and Wilson comment, "Rejoice?" Geronimo wrote these words in a prison cell, his Apache nation broken and nearly extinct. The urge for vengeance seems so futile. There's no use crying over spilt milk, and spilt blood is equally irrevocable. Yet for all its futility, the urge for vengeance is a major cause of violence. Blood revenge is explicitly endorsed in 95% of the world's cultures, and wherever tribal warfare is found, it is one of the major motives. Revenge is the motive of 10 to 20% of homicides worldwide, and a large percentage of school shootings and private bombings. When directed against groups rather than individuals, it is a major motive of urban riots, terrorist attacks, retaliation against terrorist attacks, and wars. Historians who examine the decisions that led to war in reprisal for an attack note that it is often befogged in a red mist of anger. After Pearl Harbor, for example, the American people were said to react with a mind-staggering mixture of surprise, awe, mystification, grief, humiliation, and above all, cataclysmic fury. No alternative to war, such as containment or harassment, was ever considered. The very thought would have been tantamount to treason. The reactions to the 9/11 attack were similar. The U.S. invasion of Afghanistan the following month was motivated as much by a sense that something had to be done in reprisal as by a strategic decision that it was the most effective long-term measure against terrorism. The 3,000 killings on September 11th had themselves been motivated by revenge, as Osama bin Laden explained in his letter to America. Allah the Almighty legislated the permission and the option to take revenge. Thus, if we are attacked, then we have the right to attack back. Whoever has destroyed our villages and towns, then we have the right to destroy their villages and towns. Whoever has stolen our wealth, then we have the right to destroy their economy. And whoever has killed our civilians, then we have the right to kill theirs. Revenge is not confined to political and tribal hotheads, but is an easily pushed button in everyone's brains. The homicidal fantasies to which a large majority of university students confess are almost entirely revenge fantasies. And in laboratory studies, students can easily be induced to avenge a humiliation. The students write an essay and are provided with an insulting evaluation written by a fellow student, who is a confederate of the experimenters, or entirely fictitious. At that point, Allah smiles. The student is asked to participate in a study that just happens to give him the opportunity to punish his critic by shocking him, blasting him with an air horn, or, in more recent experiments, vetted by violence-averse human subjects committees, forcing him to drink hot sauce in a bogus experiment on taste. It works like a charm. Revenge is, quite literally, an urge. In one of these experiments, just as a participant was about to deliver the retaliatory shock, the apparatus broke down, thanks to a bit of subterfuge by the experimenter, so he or she was unable to consummate the revenge. All participants then took part in a bogus wine-tasting study. The ones who had never gotten the chance to shock their insulters sampled a lot more of the wine, as if to drown their sorrows. The neurobiology of revenge begins with the rage circuit in the midbrain hypothalamus amygdala pathway, which inclines an animal who has been hurt or frustrated to lash out at the nearest likely perpetrator. In humans, the system is fed by information originating from anywhere in the brain, including the temporoparietal junction, which indicates whether the harm was intended or accidental. The rage circuit then activates the insular cortex, which gives rise to sensations of pain, disgust, and anger. Recall that the insula lights up when people feel they have been shortchanged by another person. None of this is enjoyable, and we know that animals will work to turn off electrical stimulation of the rage system. But then the brain can slip into a different mode of information processing. Proverbs like, "Revenge is sweet." Don't get mad, get even. Revenge is a dish best served cold, are hypotheses in effective neuroscience. They predict that patterns of activity in the brain can shift from an aversive anger to a cool and pleasurable seeking, the kind that guides the pursuit of delectable food. And as so often happens, the folk neuroscience is correct. Dominique de Quervain and his collaborators gave a sample of men the opportunity to entrust a sum of money to another participant who would invest it for a profit, and then either share the total with the investor or keep it for himself. The scenario is sometimes called the trust game. Participants who had been cheated out of their money were then given the chance to levy a punitive fine on the faithless trustee, though sometimes they would have to pay for the privilege. As they were pondering the opportunity, their brains were scanned, and the scientists found that a part of the striatum, the core of the seeking system, lit up, the same region that lights up when a person craves nicotine, cocaine, or chocolate. Revenge is sweet indeed. The more a person's striatum lit up, the more he was willing to pay to punish the crooked trustee, which shows that the activation reflected a genuine desire, something that the person would pay to have consummated. When the participant did choose to pay, his orbital and ventromedial frontal cortex lit up, the part of the brain that weighs the pleasure and pain of different courses of action, in this case, presumably the cost of the revenge and the satisfaction it afforded. Revenge requires the disabling of empathy, and that too can be seen in the brain. Tanya Singer and her collaborators ran a similar experiment in which men and women had their trust rewarded or betrayed by a fellow participant. Then they either experienced a mild shock to their fingers, watched a trustworthy partner get shocked, or watched their double-crosser get shocked. When a trustworthy partner got shocked, the participants literally felt their pain. The same part of the insula that lit up when they were shocked lit up when they saw the nice guy or gal get shocked. When the double-crosser got shocked, the women could not turn off their empathy. Their insula still lit up in sympathy. But the men hardened their hearts, their own insula stayed dark, while their striatum and orbital cortex lit up, a sign of a goal sought and consummated. Indeed, those circuits lit up in proportion to the men's stated desire for revenge. The results are in line with the claim by difference feminists, such as Carol Gilligan, that men are more inclined toward retributive justice and women more toward mercy. The authors of the study, though, caution that the women may have recoiled from the physical nature of the punishment and might have been just as retributive if it had taken the form of a fine, criticism, or ostracism. There is no gainsaying the cool, sweet pleasure of revenge. A villain getting his comeuppance is a recurring archetype in fiction, and it's not just Dirty Harry Callahan whose day is made when a bad guy is brought to violent justice. One of my most enjoyable moments as a moviegoer was a scene in Peter Weir's award-winning Witness. Harrison Ford plays an undercover detective who is assigned to live with an Amish family in rural Pennsylvania. One day, in full Amish drag, he accompanies them to town in their horse-drawn buggy, and they are stopped and harassed by some rural punks. True to their pacifism, the family turns the other cheek, even as one of the punks taunts and bullies their dignified father. The straw-hatted Ford does a slow burn, turns toward the punk, and to the astonishment of the gang and the delight of the art house audience, cold cocks him a good one. What is this madness called revenge? Though our psychotherapeutic culture portrays vengeance as a disease and forgiveness as the cure, the drive for revenge has a thoroughly intelligible function: deterrence. As Daly and Wilson explain, effective deterrence is a matter of convincing our rivals that any attempt to advance their interests at our expense will lead to such severe penalties that the competitive gambit will end up a net loss, which should never have been undertaken. The necessity of vengeful punishment as a deterrent is not a just-so story, but has been demonstrated repeatedly in mathematical and computer models of the evolution of cooperation. Some forms of cooperation are easy to explain. Two people are related, or married, or are teammates or bosom buddies with the same interests. So what is good for one is good for the other, and a kind of symbiotic cooperation comes naturally. Harder to explain is cooperation when people's interests at least partly diverge, and each may be tempted to exploit the other's willingness to cooperate. The simplest way to model this quandary is a positive-sum game called the Prisoner's Dilemma. Imagine a Law and Order episode in which two partners in crime are held in separate jail cells, and the evidence against them is marginal. So each is offered a deal by the assistant district attorney. If he testifies against his partner, defects against him, while the partner stays true, cooperates with the partner, that is, he will go free, while his partner is sent away for 10 years. If each of them defects and testifies against the other, they will both go to jail, but their sentences will be reduced to 6 years. If each stays loyal to the other, the prosecutor can only convict them of a lesser crime, and they will be free in 6 months. Their tragedy is that both ought to cooperate and settle for the reward of a 6-month sentence, which gives the game its positive sum. But each will defect, figuring that he's better off either way. If the partner cooperates, he goes free. If the partner defects, he only gets 6 years rather than the 10 he would get if he had cooperated. So he defects, and his partner, following the same reasoning, also defects, and they end up serving 6 years rather than the 6 months that they could have served if they had only acted altruistically rather than selfishly. The prisoner's dilemma has been called one of the great ideas of the 20th century, because it distills the tragedy of social life into such a succinct formula. The dilemma arises in any situation in which the best individual payoff is to defect while the partner cooperates. The worst individual payoff is to cooperate while the other defects. The highest total payoff is when both cooperate, and the lowest total payoff is when both defect. Many of life's predicaments have this structure, not least predatory violence, where being the aggressor against a pacifist provides all the benefits of exploitation. But being an aggressor against a fellow aggressor bloodies the two of you, so you should both be pacifists, and you would be, but for the fear that the other will be an aggressor. We have come across related tragedies such as the war of attrition, the public goods game, and the trust game, wherein individual selfishness is tempting, but mutual selfishness is ruinous. Though a one-shot prisoner's dilemma is tragic, an iterated prisoner's dilemma, in which players interact repeatedly and accumulate a payoff over many rounds, is truer to life. It can even be a good model of the evolution of cooperation, if the payoffs are doled out not in years of jail time averted or in dollars and cents, but in number of descendants. Virtual organisms play rounds of the prisoner's dilemma, which may be interpreted as opportunities to help each other, say, via mutual grooming, or to refrain from helping. The benefits in health and costs in time translates into the number of surviving offspring. Repeated runs of the game are like generations of organisms evolving by natural selection, and an observer can ask which of several competing strategies will eventually take over the population with its descendants. The combinatorial possibilities are too numerous to allow for a mathematical proof, but strategies can be written into little computer apps that compete in round-robin tournaments, and the theorists can see how they fare in the virtual evolutionary struggle. In the first such tournament, hosted by the political scientist Robert Axelrod, the winner was a simple strategy of tit for tat. Cooperate on the first move, then continue to cooperate if your partner cooperates, but defect if he defects. Since cooperation is rewarded and defection punished, defectors will switch to cooperation, and in the long run, everyone wins. The idea is identical to Robert Trivers's theory of the evolution of reciprocal altruism, which he had proposed a few years earlier without the mathematical paraphernalia. The positive sum reward arises from gains in exchange. Each can confer a large benefit to the other at a small cost to itself. And the temptation is to exploit the other, taking the benefit without paying the cost. Trivers's theory that the moral emotions are adaptations to cooperation can be translated directly into the tit-for-tat algorithm. Sympathy is cooperating on the first move. Gratitude is cooperating with a cooperator. And anger is defecting against a defector. In other words, punishing in revenge. The punishment can consist in refusing to help, but it can also consist in causing a harm. Vengeance is no disease. It is necessary for cooperation, preventing a nice guy from being exploited. Hundreds of iterated prisoner's dilemma tournaments have been studied since then, and a few new lessons have emerged. One is that tit-for-tat, simple though it is, can be dissected into features that account for its success and can be recombined into other strategies. These features have been named for personality traits, and the labels may be more than mnemonics. The dynamics of cooperation may explain why we evolved those traits. The first feature behind tit-for-tat's success is that it is nice. It cooperates on the first move, thereby tapping opportunities for mutually beneficial cooperation, and it does not defect unless defected upon. The second is that it is clear. If a strategy's rules of engagement are so complicated that the other players cannot discern how it is reacting to what they do, then its moves are effectively arbitrary, and if they are arbitrary, the best response is the strategy always defect. Tit-for-tat is easy for other strategies to cotton onto, and they can adjust their choices in response. Third, tit-for-tat is retaliatory. It responds to defection with defection, the simplest form of revenge. And it is forgiving. It leaves the gates of repentance open, so if its adversary switches to cooperation after a history of defection, tit-for-tat immediately cooperates in return. The last feature, forgiveness, turns out to be more important than everyone first appreciated. A weakness of tit-for-tat is that it is vulnerable to error and misunderstanding. Suppose one of the players intends to cooperate, but defects by mistake. Or suppose it misperceives another player's cooperation as defection and defects in retaliation. Then its opponent will defect in retaliation, which forces it to retaliate in turn, and so on, dooming the players to an endless cycle of defection, the software equivalent of a feud. In a noisy world in which misunderstanding and error are possible, tit-for-tat is bested by an even more forgiving strategy called generous tit-for-tat. Every once in a while, generous tit-for-tat will randomly grant forgiveness to a defector and resume cooperating. The act of unconditional forgiveness can flick a duo that has been trapped in a cycle of mutual defection back onto the path of cooperation. A problem for overly forgiving strategies, though, is that they can be undone if the population contains a few psychopaths who play always defect and a few suckers who play always cooperate. The psychopaths proliferate by preying on the suckers, and then become numerous enough to exploit everyone else. One successful contender in such a world is contrite tit-for-tat, which is more discriminating in its forgiveness. It remembers its own behavior, and if a round of mutual defection had been its fault because of a random error or misunderstanding, it allows its opponent one free defection and then switches to cooperation. But if the defection had been triggered by its opponent, it shows no mercy and retaliates. If the opponent is a contrite tit-for-tatter as well, then it will excuse the justified retaliation, and the pair will settle back into cooperation. So not just vengeance, but also forgiveness and contrition are necessary for social organisms to reap the benefits of cooperation. The evolution of cooperation critically depends on the possibility of repeated encounters. It cannot evolve in a one-shot prisoner's dilemma, and it collapses even in an iterated prisoner's dilemma, if the players know they are playing a limited number of rounds, because as the end of the game approaches, each is tempted to defect without fear of retribution. For similar reasons, subsets of players who are stuck with playing against each other, say because they are neighbors who cannot move, tend to be more forgiving than ones who can pick up and choose another neighborhood in which to find partners. Cliques, organizations, and other social networks are virtual neighborhoods because they force groups of people to interact repeatedly, and they too tilt people toward forgiveness because mutual defection would be ruinous to everyone. Human cooperation has another twist. Because we have language, we don't have to deal with people directly to learn whether they are cooperators or defectors. We can ask around and find out through the grapevine how the person has behaved in the past. This indirect reciprocity, as game theorists call it, puts a tangible premium on reputation and gossip. Potential cooperators have to balance selfishness against mutual benefit, not just in dealing with each other in pairs, but when acting collectively in groups. Game theorists have explored a multiplayer version of the prisoner's dilemma called the public goods game. Each player can contribute money toward a common pool, which then is doubled and divided evenly among the players. One can imagine a group of fishermen chipping in for harbor improvements, such as a lighthouse, or merchants in a block of stores pooling contributions for a security guard. The best outcome for the group is for everyone to contribute the maximum amount, but the best outcome for an individual is to stint on his own contribution and be a free rider on the profits from everyone else's. The tragedy is that contributions will dwindle to zero, and everyone ends up worse off. The biologist Garrett Hardin proposed an identical scenario called the tragedy of the commons. Each farmer cannot resist grazing his own cow on the town commons, stripping it bare to everyone's loss. Pollution, overfishing, and carbon emissions are equivalent real-life examples. But if players have the opportunity to punish free riders, as if in revenge for their exploitation of the group, then the players have an incentive to contribute, and everyone profits. The modeling of the evolution of cooperation has become increasingly Byzantine, because so many worlds can be simulated so cheaply. But in the most plausible of these worlds, we see the evolution of the all-too-human phenomena of exploitation, revenge, forgiveness, contrition, reputation, gossip, cliques, and neighborliness. So, does revenge pay in the real world? Does the credible threat of punishment induce fear in the heart of potential exploiters and deter them from exploiting? The answer from the lab is yes. When people actually act out prisoners' dilemma games in experiments, they tend toward tit-for-tat-like strategies and end up enjoying the fruits of cooperation. When they play the trust game, another version of prisoners' dilemma, which was the game used in the neuroimaging experiments on revenge, the ability of an investor to punish a faithless trustee puts enough fear into the trustee to return a fair share of the appreciated investment. In public goods games, when people are given the opportunity to punish free riders, people don't free ride. And remember the studies in which participants' essays were savaged and they had an opportunity to shock their critics in revenge? If they knew that the critic would then get a turn to shock them back, to take revenge for the revenge, they held back on the intensity of the shocks. Revenge can work as a deterrent only if the avenger has a reputation for being willing to avenge and a willingness to carry it out even when it is costly. That helps explain why the urge for revenge can be so implacable, consuming, and sometimes self-defeating, as with pursuers of self-help justice who slay an unfaithful spouse or an insulting stranger. Moreover, it is most effective when the target knows that the punishment came from the avenger, so he can recalibrate his behavior toward the avenger in the future. That explains why an avenger's thirst is consummated only when the target knows he has been singled out for the punishment. These impulses implement what judicial theorists call specific deterrence. A punishment is targeted at a wrongdoer to prevent him from repeating a crime. The psychology of revenge also implements what judicial theorists call general deterrence, a publicly decreed punishment that is designed to scare third parties away from the temptations of crime. The psychological equivalent of general deterrence is the cultivation of a reputation for being the kind of person who cannot be pushed around. You don't tug on Superman's cape. You don't spit into the wind. You don't pull the mask off the old Lone Ranger, and you don't mess around with Jim. Experiments have shown that people punish more severely, even at a price that is greater than the amount out of which they have been cheated, when they think an audience is watching. And as we saw, men are twice as likely to escalate an argument into a fight when spectators are around. The effectiveness of revenge as a deterrent can explain actions that are otherwise puzzling. The rational actor theory, popular in economics and political science, has long been embarrassed by people's behavior in yet another game, the ultimatum game. One participant, the proposer, gets a sum of money to divide between himself and another participant, the acceptor, who can take it or leave it. If he leaves it, neither side gets anything. A rational proposer would keep the lion's share. A rational respondent would accept the remaining crumbs, no matter how small, because part of a loaf is better than none. In actual experiments, the proposer tends to offer almost half of the jackpot, and the respondent doesn't settle for much less than half, even though turning down a smaller share is an act of spite that punishes both participants. Why do actors in these experiments behave so irrationally? The rational actor theory had neglected the psychology of revenge. When a proposal is too stingy, the respondent gets angry. Indeed, the neuroimaging study I mentioned earlier, in which the insula lit up in anger, used the ultimatum game to elicit it. The anger impels the respondent to punish the proposer in revenge. Most proposers anticipate the anger, so they make an offer that is just generous enough to be accepted. When they don't have to worry about revenge, because the rules of the game are changed and the acceptor has to accept the split no matter what, a variation called the dictator game, the offer is stingier. We still have a puzzle. If revenge evolved as a deterrent, then why is it used so often in the real world? Why doesn't revenge work like the nuclear arsenals in the Cold War, creating a balance of terror that keeps everyone in line? Why should there ever be cycles of vendetta, with vengeance begetting vengeance? A major reason is the moralization gap. People consider the harms they inflict to be justified and forgettable, and the harms they suffer to be unprovoked and grievous. This bookkeeping makes the two sides in an escalating fight count the number of strikes differently and weigh the inflicted harm differently as well. As the psychologist Daniel Gilbert has put it, the two combatants in a long-running war often sound like a pair of boys in the back seat of a car making their respective briefs to their parents. He hit me first. He hit me harder. A simple analogy to the way that misperception can lead to escalation may be found in an experiment by Suchwinder Schergel, Paul Bays, Chris Frith, and Daniel Wolpert, in which participants placed their finger beneath a bar that could press down on it with a precise amount of force. Their instruction was to press down on the finger of a second participant for 3 seconds with the same amount of force they were feeling. Then the second participant got the same instructions. The two took turns, each matching the amount of force he or she had just received. After 8 turns, the second participant was pressing down with about 18 times as much force as was applied in the round that got it started. The reason for this spiral is that people underestimate how much force they apply compared to how much force they feel. So they escalated the pressure by about 40% with each turn. In real-world disputes, the misperception comes not from an illusion of the sense of touch, but from an illusion of the moral sense. But in both cases, the result is a spiral of painful escalation. In many parts of this book, I have credited the Leviathan, a government with a monopoly on the legitimate use of force, as a major reducer of violence. Feuding and anarchy go together. We can now appreciate the psychology behind the effectiveness of a Leviathan. The law may be an ass, but it is a disinterested ass, and it can weigh harms without the self-serving distortions of the perpetrator or the victim. Though it is guaranteed that one side will disagree with every decision, the government's monopoly on force prevents the loser from doing anything about it, and it gives him less reason to want to do something about it, because he is not conceding weakness to his adversary and has less incentive to carry on the fight to restore his honor. The fashion accessories of Justitia, the Roman goddess of justice, express the logic succinctly. 1. Scales. 2. Blindfold. 3. Sword. A Leviathan that implements justice at the point of a sword is still using a sword. As we have seen, government vengeance itself can go to excess, as in the cruel punishments and profligate executions before the humanitarian revolution and the excessive incarceration in the United States today. Criminal punishment is often harsher than what would be needed as a finely tuned incentive designed to minimize the society's sum of harm. Part of this is by design. The rationale for criminal punishment is not just specific deterrence, general deterrence, and incapacitation. It also embraces just deserts, which is basically citizens' impulse for revenge. Even if we were certain that the perpetrator of a heinous crime would never offend again, nor set an example for anyone else, most people would feel that justice must be done, and that he should incur some harm to balance the harm he has caused.